including unique baby gifts with custom baby bedding and accessories, Brownfield Sports, Strickland Insurance, and Field of Greens.
Good morning. I'm Todd Gleason. You're listening to Focus 580 on WILL Urbana-Champaign. I'm filling in this morning for David Inge. He's away, and we'll be taking your calls this hour for Jerry Nelson, and we'll be talking about the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment. Let me background you very quickly. This was called for by the United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan in 2000. It's a report to the General Assembly that was originally entitled We the Peoples, the Role of the United Nations in the 21st Century, initiated in 2001. The objective of the Millennium Assessment is written to be to assess the consequences of ecosystem change for human well-being. And Jerry Nelson, ag economist from the University of Illinois, joins us to discuss this issue. Please, Jerry, tell me first, why were you involved and what really is an ecosystem assessment?
I'm involved as an economist. There are some 1,400 people involved in this assessment, and so it's a very large effort. Most of those people are biologists, ecologists, and scientists with that kind of background, but there were a few economists involved. My role in this activity was to take a look at the economic drivers in particular of changes to ecosystems, but I also coordinated the larger effort to look at what causes ecosystem change across two parts of the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment.
So what does that mean?
Well, maybe we should do a little history first.
Sure.
I think that's a good place to start. Ecosystems are very complicated. The world is a very complicated place. And we're only beginning to understand how complicated it is today, and we'll continue to have lots of questions about the complications. But about 20 years ago, some bench scientists in the physics side and the atmospheric side discovered that CO2, carbon dioxide, was a greenhouse gas. And they pretty quickly realized that we were putting a lot of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, driving cars and other sorts of activities. And we've discovered many more ways in which we're doing that. And that led to an effort called the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. That's been underway for about 20 years, and that's where terms like greenhouse gases and global warming come from. Some of the people that were involved in that realized that the consequences of global warming, the impacts, if you will, of global warming, were going to be spread across the Earth, and they were going to affect ecosystems. But we were also doing other things to affect ecosystems as well: agricultural expansion, cutting down trees for fuel wood, paving surfaces, and those sorts of things were all having effects on ecosystem. And the question is, so what? So this effort was, in some sense, to begin the process of answering that so what question. What are the consequences of these unprecedented changes that humans are making on the world's ecosystems? Well, for the ecosystems themselves, of course, but for the first time, asking that question in the context of what does it mean for people, for us, human beings living on the surface of the Earth.
So, for instance, were you able to focus in on North America, the globe, Africa, the different ecosystems, and how things have changed with the rainforest depletion in South America, with farming practices that are done here in the United States, with those kinds of things that happen across the globe when energy systems are put in place and mechanization happens, the electrification of the U.S. in the 30s. Historically, what kinds of things have happened? And then I suppose you projected those out to the future.
Well, the list of questions that you ask, Todd, are in some sense scratching the surface of all the potential questions you could ask. If you think that the whole issues surrounding global warming are complicated, the issues around ecosystem change are several orders of magnitude more complicated, and those questions illustrate some of the issues. So one of the first things that the Millennium Assessment did was to put together a framework for how do you even think about these questions, and that framework is available to the public. It's been available for some time. It's available in print and also on the Millennium Assessment website, which, let me say, I'll probably say it a couple of times. It's www.maweb.org. So we put together this framework. The activity began in 2002, and important elements of the framework were identifying ecosystems, identifying the contributions of ecosystems to human well-being. So we're not just concerned about the trees and the animals and the plants themselves, but what are the consequences for human well-being? And then framework asked or organized the activity into three groups. One of them was, what can we say about the condition of the world's ecosystems in 2000, hence the millennium? The second part of the activity was to say, as you were saying, what's going to happen in the future? We can't answer that question. Anybody who tries to answer that question when they're talking about the human interactions is in trouble. I mean, it's pretty easy to say what time of day the sun's going to rise in 2050. That one we can say with pretty confident about that. But you cannot make any kind of predictions with that degree of confidence about ecosystem services and conditions in 2050. So what we did was constructed scenarios, and four scenarios which were not meant to depict the really bad future and the really good future, but different aspects of how the future might develop. So that was the second part of the how we proceeded. And the third aspect was to do response options, what it is that humans could do, we could do, to address some of the potential problems that are coming down the road. Now, I should emphasize that this is not all about problems. I think that that one of the things that the biological scientists, the ecologists, recognized as a result of this effort was that humans have done some pretty amazing positive things in the last 15 years. So I want to emphasize that there's both pluses and minuses on this. The last thing to say is that all of these assessment activities that I've discussed so far were at the global level. We're focusing on the whole surface of the Earth. But that's a pretty big chunk to chew. And so we also had some groups that were doing regional assessments, or what were called subglobal assessments. And those were located in different parts of the world. There was one, for example, in South Africa, one in Central Asia, a variety in South and Southeast Asia as well. So that's kind of the scope of the activity that we were undertaking.
In the last 50 years, I see by the reports that are, I think, listed actually at maweb.org, that you assessed what the changes in the ecosystem that the humans have made have, how that has been good and bad for the human population. What were some of the conclusions that came from that assessment?
Well, let's start actually with the positive side. I mean, we think about ecosystems as providing services to humans. And one way to think about this, I'm an economist, so I like to think about capital and capital stocks and flows. Okay, so you can think about the ecosystems as having a stock of resources that we can use and we can add to or we can subtract from, and then they provide services. So some of those services that are extremely important to human well-being are food. Population of the Earth has increased from 3 to 6 million people in the last billion people. Excuse me, there's a B on that, not an M. 3 to 6 billion people, and is projected to go to something like 9 billion people by 2050. Although we have doubled the world's population in the last 50 years or so, we've managed to reduce the number of people that are malnourished. Fewer people go to bed hungry today than they did in 1950, for example. And although that trend has slowed down and perhaps even reversed a little bit in the last few years. So food is a very important ecosystem service. A second very important ecosystem service is water. We use water in a variety of ways. Irrigation, obviously, for food, but for drinking and for industrial purposes. We make more use of the world's freshwater resources than we ever have in the past. And that's actually one of the critical areas for the future, is the availability of water, fresh water, and actually, probably more correctly said, it's the effective use of water in the future. We can come back to this whole issue of effective use later in the discussion. Third thing that the ecosystems provide for us is clean air. They clean out pollutants. They clean out stuff that's bad for us and for our kids. So those are some of the examples of ways in which ecosystem services, we have used and been successful using ecosystem services in a growing way since 1950. On the negative side, should we turn to the negative side now, since that's what people tend to be interested in? There has been unprecedented conversion of ecosystem cover. We have expanded the cultivated area of the surface of the Earth in unprecedented ways that cannot be continued in the future. So what happens when you do that depends a bit on the kind of conversion that takes place. The ecosystem services that we tend to not value, tend to not notice, are things like flood protection. If you have trees on the hillside, you're less likely to have floods in the valley below. If you have trees on the hillsides and vegetative cover in other places, you're less likely to have wild swings and local climate things, you know, rainfall shocks, more thunderstorms, that sort of thing. And another one that we've recently become much more aware of is the value of ecosystems for disease regulation. Diversity in the ecosystems reduces the likelihood that diseases will spread and spread quickly, either novel diseases or currently existing diseases. One of the reasons it's surmised that we have AIDS and diseases like that is that, in fact, it's been in the monkey population for a long time, but the fact that people moved into the forests of Africa and started eating monkeys on a more regular basis meant that there was more likely to be transmission of that disease.
Did the assessment have conclusions on what directions the human populace might move in the future and specific places that could be adjusted to help sustain human life on the globe?
Well, the scenario effort looks to 2050 and looks for potential problems and potential positive outcomes in 2050. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you a little bit about that scenario effort. As I said earlier, the goal of the scenario effort was not to say, you know, here's one really bad way the world could turn out, and here's another really good way that the world could turn out. Instead, what we wanted to do was to think about human interactions with ecosystems, and the organizing theme of that, the way we thought about that at least, was to think about how societies interact globally. So this is nations. But even intranational interactions in one dimension was how societies were going to react to ecosystem changes, or were they going to be — the terminology we used was — were they going to be reactive, that is, they would wait for problems to occur and then try to solve them, or were they going to be proactive? Were they going to do the research and the forward thinking in order to figure out what likely problems were and put in place solutions ahead of time? One reason why that's, I think most people would argue that proactive is probably the way to go. It's particularly important in ecosystems where you can have dramatic changes and you can have irreversibilities. Once the stock of a particular organism is gone, it's extinct, there is no way to regain it. So that's one dimension. Is society going to be reactive or proactive? The other dimension is whether or not the world is going to move towards more integration, globalization's forces continue, or whether we're going to pull back from that and become more focused on regional efforts and less interactions across political boundaries of various kinds, but particularly national boundaries. So then that gives you four different possible futures, right? Global, regional, and reactive and proactive. And so then we have these kind of cutesy names for the possible outcomes. Global and reactive is a future that we call global orchestration.
Mm-hmm.
And that, if I had to assess, is where I think we are most likely headed. But there's a probabilistic assessment that says that, you know, that's about a 60 or 70% chance of us moving generally in that direction.
Go ahead.
Yeah, we'll continue these efforts of you know, economic integration and cultural integration, but we probably won't focus so much on dealing with especially global environmental problems. So that's number one. Number two is something called order from strength. So that's the situation where societies are reactive, they wait for the problems to occur before they do anything about them, but there is much less potential for international cooperation because we've pulled back from international organizations and we're trying to address problems. Countries try to address problems nationally or subnationally. The third axis here is where we have global and proactive. And there the terminology is technogarden, where the idea is that we will look for more technological solutions to environmental problems, and we'll actually think ahead about those, we'll plan for those, and we'll share technologies across borders. And then the fourth possibility is regionalism and a proactive approach, and that's something called adaptive mosaic. One way to think about that is that the world international programs, international institutions break down, countries go their own way, but they are very conscious about we've got to do something about these problems, we've got to think ahead.
We're speaking with Jerry Nelson this morning on Focus 580. If you'd like to join our conversation about the Millennium Assessment that the United Nations called for in the year 2000, please do so. The numbers to call are 800 toll free 222-9455 and locally 217-333-9455. Again, that's 800-222-9455 toll free and locally 217-333-9455. Let's take up the issue these four scenarios separately, and we'll start with global orchestration. The scenario, it says, depicts a globally connected society that focuses on global trade and economic liberalization. You said it's basically status quo, roughly speaking, of what we're doing at the moment, I believe, or more closely related to what's been happening in the globe over the last 50 years or so.
I would say the last – I'm looking at the last the political developments in the world in the last 5 years and trying to – and thinking about where we're likely to go. And I guess I would say that global orchestration is the most likely of the four that I see.
And that's
because we are going to –
Is that the status quo of what we've been doing, or is that where you think we'll end up?
I think that's the consequences of some decisions that are being made nationally, internationally, about both, you know, political interactions and sort of environmental interactions.
And what kind of impact might it have by the year 2050 on the ecosystems that we're discussing?
Large number of variables that you can think about. One thing that we talked about earlier was greenhouse gas emissions. One of the consequences of global orchestration is that we are less likely to, as a globe now, to deal with the problem of global warming by reducing CO2 emissions and other greenhouse gas emissions, either by sequestering them or actually reducing the amount that we put into the atmosphere, so that we wait until the temperature problems become serious enough that the whole world, in some sense, says we have to do something. We react to the appearance of this particular problem. So greenhouse gases are going to rise more rapidly than any of the others, but then drop off as we realize we have to do something about this. And the fact that we're globally orchestrated means that we can put the plan in place once we see what the problem is. So greenhouse gas emissions go up, and then they come back down relative to the other scenarios, which for example, Order from Strength sees a gradual rise. Economic growth is slower in Order from Strength, so that the amount of greenhouse gas we put into the air is less than with global orchestration. But we never get together globally to address the issues of how do we restrict the amount globally. Technogarden is a slower economic growth, but also more adaptive, so willingness to put in place measures to reduce greenhouse gases are part of that whole story, and that happens fairly soon. So that's one kind of effect that you can think about with global orchestration and looking, for example, at all the others. Another one that we examined was the number of malnourished children. Today, if we start from today, we figure that there are something on the order of 150, 170 million malnourished children in the world. With global orchestration, the number of malnourished children drops to on the order of 50 to 60 million by the year 2050. This doesn't meet the Millennium Development Goals of the United Nations, by the way, but it's a substantial decline. Order from Strength is the worst of these scenarios in terms of how the world deals with the number of malnourished children. We could run through a number of other ecosystem services, but the story that I want to convey is that the interactions between humans and how they deal with each other and the ecosystems is a very complicated one.
Service. Let's define services just very quickly again, and I suppose you can give me a more complete definition, but it seems to me that the services that you're discussing are the basic building blocks of life for humans, which would be we need to eat, we need to have water, and we need to have shelter. And other things might be what kinds of things?
Well, actually, there's an interesting list of services. Those are the obvious ones. Those are our material well-being, if you will. But there are other services that ecosystems contribute to, and other services that are not directly relevant to or not directly derived from ecosystems that the Millennium Assessment considered as well. Human freedoms, for example, is an example of a service that we get some contribution to from ecosystems. Other examples include things like culture and I don't know what the right word is to describe the fact that I really like to go to the mountains and look at the beautiful mountains. And you know, if you cut down all the trees on the mountains, they just don't look as nice. So there are these cultural amenities. There's visual amenities from ecosystems that and it's hard to put a price on. And that's one of the problems with ecosystem services. Some of them we don't put a price on, and so we don't have good measures of their value.
Let's take these up again one at a time, and we'll start with the global orchestration so that we can get a better grasp on what the Millennium Ecosystem Task Force came up with. When you look at global orchestration and you've got a connected society focusing on global trade and economics, does it work together as one to provide those services across the globe in an equal way, or does it continue the process of not giving some areas some of the human capital services like it does today? I think there's discussion, for instance, that about half of the world population, some 3 billion people, live on less than $2 a day, and I think about a billion less than a dollar a day or something thereabouts. And these, I assume, are the kinds of economics that you deal with when you're putting together the assessment.
Right. There's a series of interactions that go between kind of macroeconomic changes and the distribution of income and then the consequences for people. Global orchestration, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but the global orchestration generally does better in terms of evening out the income distribution, making the poorest of the poor less poor. And part of that part of the global orchestration scenario is more political freedoms, so that people have more voice in the process. And if you have a voice, if your voice is heard in the process, you're more likely to get results out of it. The other part of global orchestration is that because the economic output grows more rapidly than any of the others, there's a larger pie to share with everybody. And the fact that you have a larger pie, plus you have people who say, you know, hear me, I'm poor, means that they're more likely to be able to get a part of that pie. And they're able to actually then participate more from an economic perspective, contributing. So they're not outside the economic system as much.
You mentioned that policies, politicians, global politics play a role, a large role in this kind of development in any of these four scenarios. What are the things today that you have focused on, for instance, the Doha Round of the World Trade Organization, bilateral agreements that are put in place by the United States, for instance, North American Free Trade Agreement, CAFTA, which is available, the Central American Free Trade Agreement at the moment. There's similar things in Europe. There are similar kinds of agreements that are made in Asia as well. Are those the kinds of how do those agreements impact what's been put into this, or do they at all?
Well, I think they do. What we did not do in this, what we chose purposely not to do, was to talk about individual countries or except in the most general senses about individual kinds of organizations. The danger that if you do that is then people will focus on the specific and ignore the larger general. The problem with not having the specific discussion is that then it's harder to tell a story that's kind of sexy, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we don't talk specifically about things like NAFTA or the ASEAN Association of Southeast Asian Nations, for example,
sure.
or any of those kind of organizations. You have to read a bit between the lines about the role of those organizations in these various scenarios. But I think it's fair to say that, for example, global orchestration, you will see an expansion of discussions across regional organizations. So ASEAN would speak more with the EU, and the SARC, which is the South Asian Association, might speak more with the organization in Latin America. So with global orchestration, there would be more opportunity, more discussion across organizations. But one of the key things that I think we need to talk about here is this whole issue of the proper scale at which to address the problem. And the problem is that there are lots of problems. Okay. So, if you think back to this potted history of the Middle Ages, you walk down the middle of the street and somebody throws sewage out on top of your head because there's no regulation about how you dispose of your sewage. Well, that's a problem that people within a particular community can say, we are a bunch of us not happy with this. Let's do something about it. So in econ speak, that's called internalizing the externality. We make it illegal for you to dump your sewage out the second floor window onto the people walking by. And what does society do? Well, it puts in place property rights that say you can't do that, and then it puts in place sewers. So there's a legal development, and then there's also the building of some physical infrastructure. Okay, that's kind of a small problem. When you get to the problems that we're discussing, the coordination issues become really severe. Think about, for example, global warming is the really obvious one that people know about. I drive my car, I put carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. It's, I have very little effect, and B, there's nothing much that anybody can do about it. The same thing applies at the national level. The U.S. by itself decides to restrict carbon dioxide emissions, and other people will do it. It doesn't make any difference. I mean, the U.S. restriction doesn't benefit them unless they can somehow get everybody to go along with the same kind of restrictions. An intermediate example is a watershed. Watersheds don't follow political boundaries. They go across all sorts of political boundaries. So you got states, you got national boundaries. We got this problem in the U.S. with the Red River in Canada. Because watersheds don't follow political boundaries. So how do you coordinate? And these environmental problems, these ecosystem problems, are more often than not problems because they go across political boundaries, and we need to find mechanisms to coordinate across political boundaries. So coming back to your first question about global orchestration, the idea there is that those mechanisms are found, that we find ways to do these coordination across political boundaries to get to the right scale of the problem.
And then order from strength is regionalized answers to those questions.
Well, and in many cases, we don't find answers to those questions because you can't. Because if you can't operate internationally with, let's say, global warming, reducing climate CO2 emissions, then there is no incentive for an individual country or even a group of countries to reduce CO2 emissions. So we never find a way to make that happen. So and one of the important findings about the Millennium Assessment is, in fact, the role of, economists would have said, we knew this already, but for ecologists and biologists, the role of property rights is very important. But there are very important roles for public institutions. We talked about building sewers. That's one obvious one. Institutional developments, putting the level playing field, so that we put in place rules and regulations that everybody is supposed to meet. And if everybody meets them, then, you have much less likelihood of free rider problems.
Are they trade rules? Are they environmental rules? Are they a series of both sets?
Well, they're both. They're trade, they're environment, they're those are the two biggies, I suppose.
Sure.
Capital flows is another. International capital flows is one. Things like management of species transmissions. I mean, one of the big costs to the U.S. economy on this thing is actually the consequence of introduced species, one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
Around here we have the problem with that clam that, what's it called? The
zebra
mussel. The zebra mussel is an example of things that have caused great economic damage, and that was because somebody had dumped some bilge water out of a ship into the Great Lakes probably 50 years ago, something like that.
And the zebra mussel does a lot of damage in the Great Lakes and other areas and the water system that is available there. And the soybean aphid is an invasive species that came in from someplace else. An example from here to Europe is the Western corn borer. The Western rootworm, corn rootworm,
right.
That was
But the Europeans gave us the
but the Europeans gave us the European corn borer, right. Which is in another right. example. They also gave us the silkworm, I believe, and which has had some problems along the way. And the ash borer for trees
came from China.
The emerald green ash borer came from China, and that came in probably in pallets. And so those are the kinds of things that we're talking about to some extent.
Right.
How does the United Nations go about taking this fairly lengthy document and making something worthwhile out of it? I mean, what comes of this sort of assessment?
That's a very good question. First of all, let me say that this is not an official United Nations document. This effort was endorsed by Kofi Annan. He called for it. But it was actually an independent – it's very unique, actually. It's an independent effort organized by influential scientists but without any particular institutional affiliation. There was an informal affiliation with a variety of organizations. But unlike the climate change activities, which were specifically organized by governments, this is independent. And so as an independent organization, it has some freedoms that you wouldn't if you were the UN. So you can say some things that you might not otherwise say. But the issue is reaching the audiences that you want to reach. So this is one of the activities. This is one of the way in which we try to reach the audiences.
Mm-hmm.
There are a series of reports. If you go to the Millennium Assessment website, you'll see that you can download a variety of things today, and there are more things coming online. So there's a 20-page summary that's kind of the grand global overview. There's a 218-page synthesis document. There is a document that was just released recently focusing on biodiversity. And in the next 3 months, there will be documents that focus on business and the private sector on I have that list here somewhere. Watersheds, on human health, the effects of ecosystems for human health. This is a very large elephant, and so what we want to do is to pull out the cogent pieces for different audiences. So there are these different reports, and there have been a variety of different kinds of outreach efforts. One of the things you'll find when you go to the Millennium Assessment website is you can actually download some data. You can download some other kind of visual presentation material, or you will be able to pretty shortly. So a variety of outreach efforts. The history of the climate change activities was that there have been four rounds to date, starting about 1980, and we're in the fourth round. I'm in the middle of the fourth round right now. The first round was really, what do we know about what's going on? And the answer was not very much. And what kind of questions do we need to ask? And I think that's where we are with the ecosystem stuff today. I mean, there are some cases where the information that we had was just incredibly bad. I mean, unexpectedly bad. One of the things that frustrated me, you'd think that if there was one thing that we could know, it was how much has agricultural area expanded between, say, 1980 and 2000 around the world. Right?
I would guess that we'd have a good handle on that.
And you'd be wrong if you guessed that. And I was really surprised. We ended up with a chart that represented the best efforts that we could come up with that had major areas of agricultural area expansion in the United States, in the North Central Plains of the United States, between 1980 and 1990. Area expansion, Todd, does that make any sense to you? Ireland, area expansion, agriculture area expansion in Ireland. The island of Java, which I happen to know something about and has been, human activities that have been going on there forever, and there was no possibility for agricultural expansion between 1980 and 1990. Relatively little in Africa, and some reduction in agricultural area in China between 1980 and 1990. Now, to me, those are all, at best, iffy observations, and some of them are just flat out wrong. I know from personal experience, but it's a result of taking the official data that we can get our hands on, massaging it to the best that we can right now, and coming up with numbers that, you know, you kind of know are just don't make sense.
Sure. Maybe the data should have been collected from NASA, the satellites, I suppose, rather than official data. I would think China.
No, we use NASA. We use NASA. There were satellite data in there. There was official statistics from the U.S. For example, the thing about the U.S. statistics, there's a couple of different agencies that present them, and they use a couple of different definitions. So, you know, for example, here's a crazy one, and I still don't know the answer to this. When you switch from set-asides to conservation reserve programs, which we did in the mid-1980s, mm-hmm. how do you count that land, that set-aside land that is no longer set aside and the land that used to be agriculture but maybe was set aside now goes into conservation reserve? Well, I still don't know the answer, but I think the explanation for the supposed area expansion in the 1980s was in fact a definitional problem.
And that set-aside counted as agricultural land, but CRP did not.
Well, no. CRP, apparently, because there was area expansion, CRP then was – set-aside wasn't counted as agriculture. CRP was, and so therefore it looks like because you have this land moving from not agriculture, set-aside to
– conservation.
Conservation, which is agriculture for some reason, that then you have an area expansion. You see, it's very – and we can get – there are lots of details like that, but where our database – our The basis on which we make these observations, many of these observations, and that's the one you would think we would know the most, the data is just really, really weak.
As economists, when you were dealing with global warming and weather conditions, and there are some numbers out there that suggest, for instance, if we want to localize it a bit, that the state of Illinois will look much more like Texas and the Gulf of Mexico in, I think, by 2090
something
like that in terms of what the weather conditions might be here further to Ontario. You just sort of move it up, and if you want to be in Illinois, you move to Ontario.
Right.
Did you do some searching in those areas and global warming and make assessments economically?
Because this was a global exercise, we didn't do the regional stuff, but I'm familiar with the work that you're – and there's other ways in which you can tease out sort of regional implications. I think for Illinois and the Midwest more generally, implications for agriculture are, as you say, the climate in Illinois – at some time between 2050 and 2100, it's going to look a lot more like Oklahoma and Texas than it does now, which means warmer, more variation, more dramatic variation in weather, and longer growing seasons. And so what that means is that it might still be possible to grow corn and soybeans, but we ought to be thinking about some other crops besides corn and soybeans in the Midwest, things that are more drought tolerant. We may be able to have two or three plantings per year instead of the one that we typically have, at least in the northern part of the Midwest. But you also ought to realize that there are other changes going on around the world. We will probably continue to have fairly abundant rainfall, and so it's likely that we might be exporting our water, so to speak, in the form of agricultural crops even more than we do now, because as water scarcities expand around the world, partly because of climate change, but more importantly, just because population growth and economic growth means more demand for water, we may become a supplier, if you will, of water for human consumption in the form of feed grain even more than we are, food of various kinds, actually, not just grain, than we are now.
You touched on that earlier, that we'd come back to water. And is this the crux of what you were looking to discuss at that point, or is there more about water as water?
Water is another case of the issue of property rights, where property rights are really a problem. In many parts of the world, including in the United States, people get water for free. Now, you and I have to pay for our water that we put on our lawns and that we drink and we use for our washing, and we pay a pretty hefty price. Consumer use of water is typically priced pretty heavily, mm-hmm. but agricultural use of water is not, and there are issues with water flowing across boundaries in the form of rivers where, You know, if you decide to put a dam in your country and it blocks the water flowing into the country downstream, well, you know, who's going to regulate that? So one of the what the precise situation in the future will be with respect to our perceived availability of water is to the extent that we can properly value it and then make users actually pay for the value of what they're getting. That's what I wanted to come back to, this issue of property rights with respect to water.
Go ahead.
The fact that if we're going to reduce the shortages of water, the regional shortages of water, we'll have to find mechanisms to put a price on that water that appropriately reflects its value to the users. People in California that are getting that free water probably not going to be too happy to hear that, but there's farmers in other parts of the world for which that's the case as well.
The economist in you is going to make some people very unhappy, I'm almost certain. We have a caller on line one that would like to join this conversation. You have a question or comment for Jerry Nelson?
Yeah, the idea of putting a cost on water, and since your guest is an economist, is really so important because so many businesses depend on their profits showing up because they don't have any way of computing a full cost in terms of things that are off the books, like, you know, what the damage to the ecosystem system, stuff like that. But I had two quick questions. One is about the zebra mussel. I think I read recently that the some people, at least, think that the quality of the lake water has improved considerably, and they're attributing it to the zebra mussel. I was wondering if you happen to know about that. I'll ask the other question after you've answered that.
Well, I've heard those reports too. I'm not a biologist, so you know, I'm just casual speculation. What I heard was that they filter a tremendous volume of water, and so they're. And that's why they grow so rapidly, and as a result, they filter out a lot of the stuff that would otherwise be in the water.
Yeah, so it's extremely complicated system you're talking about. And the other thing is that I have been running errands while I was listening to you, so I don't know if you've really touched on this, but I just wanted to know if, from your point of view, how would you characterize the resistance to amongst the scientists, how would you characterize those people who are saying, you know, the data is too weak, you know, it could be just natural variation? Are you able to talk about that at all? Could you talk up a little bit, flesh them out a little bit? Are they really respectable people that, you know, highly accomplished people that are saying that kind of thing? If there are anybody saying that, no, I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Thank you very much, caller.
Yeah, I believe that last question was with respect to whether or not we're actually experienced human-induced global warming. I mean, the issue is, there have been natural cycles of global temperatures rising and then falling that we can detect in the past, and the question is whether or not there, on top of that, is this effect of human activity. And I think the views of the atmospheric sciences community, of which I'm not one, has been that the number of people who are skeptics about human-induced anthropogenic climate change are going down, and the number of people who are persuaded by the evidence that continues to come in are increasing. I think that there have been many credible scientists 10 years ago who said, you know, it's a little early to be making really strong statements, and I think those numbers of people have gone down quite a bit. The economist in me then says, we don't know with 100% certainty today, and we certainly don't know the range of temperatures. And so the question is, what are the costs and benefits of trying to deal with the problems today as opposed to the problems of waiting until the problems become evident in the future? And my economist answer to that is that a little prevention early is probably not a bad thing, as long as it's not too expensive. And there's a lot of waffle words in what I just said, like a little expensive and not too far in the future.
Typical of economists.
That's right. On the one hand and on the other hand.
We do have a caller on our toll-free line from Chicago. If you'd like to join the conversation with Jerry Nelson this morning on the Millennium Assessment, please give us a call at 800-222-9455 or locally 217-333-9455. From Chicago, good morning. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you. I'm reminded of Lester Brown of the Worldwide Watch Institute has talked about many of the areas and environments such as you have brought out and forewarned about this matter of energy and other things that are so many critical factors going into everything for sustainability of our future. And as others have said, this planet can't sustain it. We would need two planets in order to continue, you know, even thinking of going the way we're doing it. But getting back to the economic matter, it seems that certain factors drive the direction which we're going as a result of the economic preponderance of wealth that has gone into areas of economic paper, like derivatives and hedge funds and so forth that belong to an exclusive club of billionaires and others who have nothing to do with the wealth but put it into risk, and they're not about to put things into risk if it means diminishing the returns on their investments. So we're in that they're buying the Sisyphus dilemma of trying to push the obstacle up to the top of the mountain only to see it fall again depending upon the whims of circumstances and especially the economy, which says go, 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 increase, expand, rather than go slower, become conservative, be constructive instead of destructive, and such as the wars and the preponderance of things that are going on in the world. So we've got quite a scenario to deal with, but all of it interplays, and I thank you for your program and all the things you're highlighting. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, caller. So the question, I suppose, out of that is that money sometimes is what drives a lot of things. I suppose as an economist, you probably would agree with that, and that if money is to fix some of the problems, that money invested would have to be invested and lost. Would that be the case?
Let me respond to the caller, actually, and then your question in a couple of ways. One of the great marketing advantages that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change had was a great term, you know, global warming, a two-word phrase that really captures kind of the essence of what they were concerned about. And the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, first of all, that title is tremendously long and complicated, and it's hard to remember. But second of all, because it's such a complex story that it's really hard to come up with that single catchphrase. To me, the thing that I like to use is a phrase that says, our children are at risk. And I say that because I think that the vast majority of the people that are listening to the phone call, the show today and thinking about calling in, are really probably not going to suffer greatly from the environmental problems that we potentially see down the road. It's really going to hit our kids if it happens. So that's number one. Our children are at risk. But the second part about that is that the fact that they're at risk and we recognize it means that there is a potential to do something about it. Economic growth does not mean more use of things. It's also about services. It's about enjoying, you know, a nice concert or listening to the radio instead of, you know, having another Big Mac or something like that. So as economies grow, people tend to use more services than they do the physical things that we sometimes associate with economic growth. So that if we can steer the economy with the right kind of policies, we can steer it on a path towards more sustainability. So the at-risk part of that statement says, think about your children. Think about ways to deal with the problems that today so that they are not going to suffer the consequences of our behavior today.
What would be an example that you personally might use as a policy or something that you could think about that would have that kind of impact?
Well, we've talked about climate change. We really need to restrict CO2 emissions, and we need to find mechanisms, market-based mechanisms to do that. In fact, market-based mechanisms exist to do that already, and merely it's a matter of implementing them and finding the right level at which to implement them. We can put a tax. If the United States, I'm going to make a very bold statement here, 2 years ago when gasoline prices were on the order of $1.50, had put a tax of 50 cents on a gallon of gas. The price at that time would have gone from $1.50 to around $2, which it is today. The Treasury would not be, we would not be having the kind of budgetary deficit that we have today, and we would have significantly reduced our carbon dioxide emissions because people would say, you know, if gas is $2, we're going to buy cars that are a little more conserving of gasoline. So one thing that we could do that would be very easy, would solve a lot of economic problems, gasoline tax. Instead of giving all that money to the Saudis and the Iranians, let's keep it in the United States.
An interesting concept, and was floated by a presidential candidate, I believe, in the 1980 election. A representative from the state of Illinois had floated that gasoline tax, I think, at 50 cents at that
point, too. Could be.
So, an interesting idea. As we wrap up, we have about 3 minutes to finish our discussion. Any points that we haven't discovered or discussed that you wanted to make sure we got across this morning?
Property rights, number one, the importance of property rights in making problems become part of – markets become part of the solution rather than part of the problem. The problem of coordination, the fact that environmental problems, some of the most severe environmental problems, go across political boundaries, and we need to find ways to coordinate it. Information. You can't identify a problem if you don't have information on what the situation is, and our information base on a whole variety of environmental problems is really very weak. We're in the early stages of this assessing ecosystems, and I think we need to do a lot more for our children.
We thank you for joining us this morning. Jerry Nelson is an ag economist in the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences here at the University of Illinois. We've been talking about the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment. If you'd like to learn more about that, you can visit a website. It's www.maweb.org. That's .org. Jerry, thanks much for joining us this morning. I enjoyed our discussion, and I'm sure we'll have more of them over time. Of course, I work for University of Illinois Extension and in the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences, and have had discussions like this with Jerry several times over the past decade or so. Thanks much for joining us this morning.
Glad to do it.
Taking a look now at what the forecast looks like in Urbana-Champaign. This from Mike Sola this morning. He's calling for skies today that'll be sunny. They'll be breezy early, then clouds increasing during the afternoon. The high about 78. The winds out of the northwest at 12 to 24 miles an hour. And tonight he says it'll be partly cloudy. The low will be 49. Winds out of the north to northeast this evening at 6 to 12 miles an hour.